You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show, and indeed Happy New Year, Happy New 2017. What better way to start this year, which I think is either the fifth or the sixth year of the Comedians Comedian Podcast. I can't be bothered to look it up, and I'm terrible with dates, events and things that have happened. But what better way to start the year than with a fabulous in-depth conversation with the incredible Welsh anecdotalist, collaboration fan. There's some fascinating stuff on word choice here and about how his persona differs when performing in Welsh or English. He's just an absolute brilliant comic, and I'm sure you're going to love hearing from him. This is Ellis James.
I wanted to be in sitcoms. I went to write sitcoms, and someone in a pub said that they get a lot of their talent, producers do, from the stand-up circuit.
Is that right?
Yeah, so you should think about doing this. And he was working as a stand-up in London, but he's from Cardiff. But I'd never been to stand-up before, so I put myself down for an open mic night, and then I went to the Cardiff Glee. And I remember the bill. It was Alistair Barry, Gavin Webster, Kerry Marks, and Steve Williams.
Okay.
So obviously, anyone who knows about the circuit knows that's a really good bill. And I'd never been to comedy before. And Alistair Barry walked on. He was comparing. And he instantly asked the person in the front row if they were together or what they did for a living. And I had my hands gripping onto the chair because I thought, he's just improvising. And then the guy said, yeah, I'm a teacher. And his wife said, yeah, I work in data entry. And he had stuff on that. I thought, oh my God, how did he know that I was going to be a teacher and that she was going to work in data? I thought, the man's a shaman. The man's incredible. And then he asked if there were any locals in, if anyone in from the valleys. He had stuff on that. I thought, he's not even Welsh, but he's got this stuff. And then he asked a couple, I don't know, he would have asked them how long they've been together or whatever, just normal comparing stuff. And obviously Alistair's a very good compare, and he had gear on it, and it just knocked my socks off. And I thought, why isn't he on television? Why aren't Parliament talking about this guy? He should be in the papers.
This is incredibly evocative, and I think this will sum up. I know there'll be people listening to this who, like me, remember that phase of their own comedy awakening. And there'll be people listening to this who haven't had that yet, and people who are having it, who had it at the gig they're driving home from tonight.
Yeah.
That's so important to remember that at one point it seemed magical and impossible.
Absolutely extraordinary. And then he did some prepared material, and then he did some stuff about Welsh road signs, and I just thought, he's going to be Prime Minister or something. He can do it all. And then Gavin Webster came on and was amazing. I thought, why isn't this guy on telly?
Yeah.
This guy's also amazing. And then it was an interval, and then Alistair did more crowd work. And by this point, I'm now absolutely beside myself. And then he brought Steve Williams on, and he was local, and he had good stuff on Newport and Cardiff. And I thought, why is this guy not in the Western Mail? Why is he not on BBC Wales? Why is he not on Radio Wales? And then Carey came on and was amazing. I thought, why is this guy not on telly? Why are these four guys not on telly? So then I did my open mic night, And it was in a pub, and it was dreadfully set up.
Did you, travelling to that open mic night, did you expect that when you got there it would resemble the Glee Club?
I didn't know what to expect, actually, because I'd never been to open mic music or anything.
Okay.
But I had...
This was an open mic comedy night, though.
It was, yeah. Okay, and it had just started, and it was an embryonic version of something that's still going in Cardiff, actually. So I turned up, and I had about 10 minutes, and we can come on to this in a bit, but I thought, well, I was the funny person at school, I was the funny person at university, and I was temping in an office, and I was making people laugh, and I thought, so what makes them laugh? Which I think is probably the wrong way around.
Okay.
So I thought, well, how did I used to make the townies in school laugh, or the townies in my hometown, you know, how did I make them like me? And I thought, well, I thought it was probably quite crude, actually, looking back. It wasn't really me, but I thought there's going to be more of them than the people who are interested in the stuff I'm interested in. So I had this set and I did 5 or 6 minutes and a bit of beginner's luck. And there's a certain charm to someone trying it for the first time, I think. So it was all right. It was fine. But the adrenaline was such, because I'd never done any performing, that I didn't sleep at all that night. At all. So I'd work the next day. So I went to work having not slept for 24 hours. Absolutely bouncing. And I remember thinking at about 3 a.m, the gig went well. And I'd made an aside, which I didn't think was a joke. And there were a hockey team there who were having a drink after their game, who obviously didn't realise it was open mic comedy on it. And they were ignoring it. And I made an aside and a girl laughed. I thought, even my asides were funny. I've got it all. So, so it was about 3 a.m. I remember thinking, right, Jeff Green, but I haven't seen him on telly for ages. I think he's moved to Australia. Joe Brand, Eddie Izzard, but he's sort of in films now. Lee Evans is in films. Badil and Skinner, well, they haven't been on telly for a little bit. Jack D's still going. Roy Chubby Brown is a different, well, he's a different circuit. Bernard Manning, I think, has Les Dawson died? The four at the Glee, I thought, I'm like the 13th comic. I thought, obviously there was the three who were on tonight. I thought, that's 16. I thought, I'm the 17th comic. There has to be room for a 17th comic. I was thinking, if I'm as funny as I was tonight, I'll be, what is it, February? I'll be a millionaire by...
No.
Surely if I'm the 17th comic, Britain can sustain, can probably sustain 20 comics. So then I went back a month later or something and... The second one went quite well, actually, and but there were more acts on the bill. I thought, all right, I'm the 21st comic. And then a month after that, I thought, okay, I'm the 25th comic, but I'm still fairly confident at this stage. And then someone said, do you work for Mirth Control? I said, no, what's that? He went, oh, it's this guy called Jeff Whiting, and he runs about 120 gigs up and down the country. Look at his website. And suddenly I realised if he could service 120 gigs, there must be hundreds, if not thousands of comics, and then the maths went from being in my favour to being dead against me, and it was horrendous. And then I had a bad gig as well. I had my first really sort of really bad one, a real shock, and I just thought, it's never gonna work.
The kind of naivety that you're
describing.
25. Then.
That's the embarrassing thing. But I couldn't think of more than about 15 comics because I was like, Alan Davis, well, he does Jonathan Creek now. He doesn't really do stand-up anymore. And I just couldn't think of... I thought Rob Ryan does Human Remains and Marion. I couldn't think of...
You're someone who, like, you've got a degree, you've got an MA as well,
I believe.
I'm not saying, like, how can you possibly have thought that from the point of view of you must be an idiot?
Well, it was...
What I slightly want to challenge you on is... It seems to me that representation of yourself as this naive idiot is something that I consider very Ellis. That's a thing you mine very effectively for comedy. And how true to the actual you that was turning up for those gigs is that?
Well,
that story is funny and heartwarming, and I believe it's true, but come on, how true is that?
It was pre-Live at the Apollo, so there was almost no stand-up on television, and the stand-up on telly, it was probably 7 or 8 comics. It was pre-Mickey Flanagan and Rod Gilbert and Greg Davis and all the comics Live at the Apollo made famous. It was, I think it was before Mock the Week, or certainly I don't think I watched Mock the Week. And I think I always loved sitcoms. That was a thing. So as a teenager, I grew up in a town that was very devoted to underage drinking. But I started puberty quite late.
Okay.
So even though they'd serve anyone, they drew the line at me. And so I had to stay in. That was the thing. And so I watched a lot of comedy, but it was all sitcoms because BBC Two in the 90s was Red Dwarf and Alan Partridge and Brass Eye was on Channel 4, but they were, you know, the Fast Show and I really liked Shooting Stars. So stand-up wasn't really a thing that inspired me as a teenager. It was, if you talk to someone like Sean Walsh, he grew up watching Lee Evans and Dylan Moran, and I didn't. It was Coogan. It was all Coogan and the group Coogan was a part of who did the day-to-day primarily. And so I just didn't know very much about stand-up. And I thought it was just this really small niche thing. And it wasn't until I heard about Mirth Control that I realised that it was massive. And then suddenly I'd fallen in love with it. I jumped feet first into it. And then it was daunting but kind of exciting because I realised that it could be my job. And I really hated my job. And I thought, well, if this is just my job and I'm not on telly, that's absolutely fine because it means I'm not working in an office.
What was the, because you work in Welsh as well, you're one of something like seven Welsh comedians. I think is that an accurate
I reckon there's probably 10 to 15, I think.
Of those 10 to 15, how many tonight could do an hour in Welsh?
Well, S4C have recently started giving hours to people, and they've got this showcase thing for Welsh talent now. So
okay,
like Noel James and Tudur Owen are probably the two that you will have heard of.
Yes.
Dan Thomas as well, you might have worked with Dan.
Yes.
And, you know, Noel's been doing gigs in Welsh probably for as long as he's been doing them in English. But it is a tiny niche scene.
Basically.
Yeah.
Who've got an hour or two that they could do it.
Yeah, yeah. And there's comedians like Stefan Allen, who you might have worked with.
Yes, I know Stefan.
And he does it in Welsh as well. But it is a tiny... There's also a scene of people who do gigs only in Welsh who don't really perform in English. But again, if you add them all together, it's a bit like Welsh rock was in the late 70s when there was 9 bands.
Okay. Okay.
So it will grow hopefully into something much bigger.
So what was, in terms of like your discovery, that taste for stand-up in the very early days for you, did you consider doing it in Welsh? Was Welsh your first language?
It is my first language. But it's the language I would speak with my parents and my sisters, and it was the language I went to school in. But growing up, I think I worked out the other day that the nearest comedy club would have been Jester's in Bristol, which is 120 miles away.
Okay.
So
no clubs, but occasional sort of... I talked to Stefan a little bit about this. He sort of said there's an audience for Welsh comedy.
I'm talking about when I was a teenager.
Sure. I think he suggested, I'm not quite sure what time period he meant, whereby part of the audience for Welsh comedy are people who are happy to see the language be spoken in public who aren't necessarily comedy fans.
Oh, there's absolutely that. And in the same way that I knew people who'd buy all Welsh language records to try and support the scene.
Yes,
there were definitely... I did an hour on television on the Welsh Channel 4 S4C last year, and I wrote it from scratch. It was completely different to any of the stuff I did in English. So I did a mini tour beforehand to work the stuff up, and it was 13 previews. So if you were working in English, you would do probably 30, 40 previews, Edinburgh, you'd tour it on your own, and then you'd do two nights in London, and they'd get the best stuff from both nights. Whereas I had 13 gigs, and then the record, and I was going to get one stab at it. So it
13
was like,
gigs to non-necessarily regular comedy club audiences.
Oh, yeah. So I turned up in a miners institute, and there were 10 people in a committee room, sat round a round table, but that's one of my 13 gigs. So if that was an Edinburgh preview, I'd pull it, but it was too important.
Okay. So is it fair to say that the description of you starting off and thinking, like pre-hearing about Mirth Control, there's only 20 comics in the world, that's a fairly accurate description of you as a Welsh language comic?
Yes, that's true, yeah. I mean, the thing I noticed from doing the Welsh gigs was there hasn't been very much, if any, comedy on S4C, or if it is, it's really geared towards old people. And there isn't anything modern of the kind of stuff that Noel does or I do or Tudur does. It's all really geared towards my grandparents' generation. And because I'd done stand-up for 11 years and I'd done, I don't know, 3,000 gigs in Edinburgh shows and I'd been to Australia and all that sorts of stuff, I was of an English standard. What I was doing was modern as well. And the other really exciting thing with Welsh stand-up is that Noel does what he does in English in Welsh, so he sort of twists and plays with language.
Yeah.
And Tudur has got a very different on-stage persona to me. So what I do, it's slightly more observational than in English, and it's much more nostalgic, but there's all these open goals because nobody's done it yet.
Okay.
So in the same way that Peter Kay had all of the 80s adverts to choose from,
yeah,
because no one had done that stuff prior to him, I've got all of Welsh culture. So it's actually...
Because Noel's never going to touch that stuff.
He's just not... He's got nothing. Well, there's no overlap.
And I'm not familiar with Tudor's act. I've never... Does no, he work in English as well?
He works in English as well, okay. Primarily in the north of England, I think.
Okay.
But he's done Edinburgh. But it's a very different thing. And Tudor's a bit older than I am as well. So it's coming from a different place. And just... it was amazing that no one had touched upon this stuff. And the thing that was... exciting was, as a storytelling anecdotalist, the raw material I had at my disposal for my first Edinburgh show was far better and more exciting than the raw material I had at my disposal for my fourth Edinburgh show.
Yes.
But by my fourth Edinburgh show, I was a considerably better comic.
That is such an interesting observation.
So,
absolutely. The comic I am now could really do something with the story about being a street performer that I spent in 2010. Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
I experienced this thing that no one other than bilingual comics will ever be able to experience. I had basically a second attempt at my first show, but with 10 years of experience.
God!
Because... People find this difficult to believe. I spoke only Welsh at home, Welsh school, Welsh Sunday school. My grandparents couldn't speak very much English, and the county I grew up in was majority Welsh, so I used to hear it all the time. So it wasn't a weird hobby or a middle-class handshake. It was absolutely the language in the area where I grew up. And so there was all this stuff from my childhood that I couldn't discuss in English because no one would get the references, even in English-speaking Wales. So there's stuff I'd like...
Yeah, can you give us an example of a reference?
For instance, in my primary school, absolutely every kid in my primary school went to Sunday school. And their parents almost all went to chapel. Whereas in the English primary school, across the road, it was far fewer people. And because Welsh speakers, in the main, this has changed, I think, tended to be more religious, chapel goers. So it was a big part of the community. We used to do... what's the hell of a treasure hunts in these big treasure hunts, right? See, the thing is, I've never done a treasure hunt in English, so I had to try and work out what a treasure hunt, because it's a hell of a dress, so that's how I think of it.
Okay, yes.
So I had all this stuff on treasure hunts, and it just wouldn't work in Swansea, I don't think, at an English gig, and it wouldn't work in Cardiff. But it was all these references, and you could see light bulbs going off in people's heads in the audience.
Yes.
As I was telling these jokes. So for my first Edinburgh show was in 2009. So because a lot of it was about childhood, it was basically half my experience I could mine. So you then get a second go at the other half of your experience,
God.
But with 10 years of experience. And so the show was written far more quickly. I think if I hadn't done Edinburgh, I wouldn't have been able to write it that quickly because I had the skills of writing to a deadline. So I used to record the gigs on two different dictaphones because if I lost the raw material of one, it was a catastrophe.
Yes.
And then I would drive to the next show, listening to it back again and again, talking to myself, and I would stop it and I would improvise. So I knew my previews very well because I had to be off notes as quickly as possible because what I've noticed is when you're an anecdotalist or a storyteller, not most of my laughs, but a lot of my laughs are from the performance, but you can't perform a routine you don't know. So you have to. So often I will ditch a story because I don't think it's funny because I don't know it. And so I'm not performing it properly. I'm just telling it. But once I'm performing it and I'm doing the act outs and the voices and the characters and all that sort of stuff, then there's often something in it I didn't have the time to play with. So I had to get to the learning it stage far more quickly than I would if I was writing an English show.
And let's stay with that for a second because that, I mean, you are one of the, I mean, you've heard this show, a lot of these interviews. Almost everyone says I record them, but I never listen back. I definitely listen back, but never more than once. I think you must be the only guest who've ever on the show who's listened back to one of their shows more than once.
I found my 2012 Edinburgh show, which was in English, obviously.
Yeah.
And I was going to send it to you. And the best version of that show was probably a preview I did in Cardiff with Lloyd Lankford, but I couldn't find it. But I had this show that was recorded in Edinburgh, and I listened to the first 2 or 3 minutes, and then I couldn't listen to any more, and I thought, I think it's all right, but I don't know. If it's a car crash, I can't send him that, and I can't take that chat. Whereas with the Welsh thing, the record was on the 17th of September, and it had to be perfect by then. And so suddenly, all of your hang-ups and all of your neuroses go out the window. So in the same way that if... I haven't done Edinburgh since 2012, and I keep telling myself, oh, I can't write stand-up like I used to. But if my agent said, you're doing Edinburgh, I've cleared your diary, I could write an Edinburgh show because I'm one of those people who needs a deadline. So I think to be honest, I think three comics together who know each other and are friends could probably write a three-star Dimmer Show in a week if you gave them a room and five previews.
They could probably write a three-star Edinburgh show in a week
yeah. Because I think almost everyone works better with a bit of adrenaline in them, in the same way that I could never write good stuff in the house. All of my best jokes come within 20 minutes of performing or within 20 minutes of performing when I've got adrenaline in me, because all of my best decisions are informed by adrenaline. Because, like, how can I put this? I'm really into 60s psychedelia. I love it. And the other day I bought some quite obscure records and I texted the one friend I know who really likes that stuff. But when you're in your house surrounded by your stuff, you can kid that everyone else is interested in, you know, Today at Parliament or 60s psychedelia or 1980s FA Cup finals or whatever. And then you get to the show, the preview or the new material, and you think, oh my God, that's... Of course not.
Oh, how many times have you arrived at a gig thinking, going to chuck in a bit of new tonight, yeah, and just literally walked in the room and thought, of course not.
But then you can just tell from looking at people. And so, you know, I need that adrenaline to function. I think if you gave me 5 years to write an Edinburgh show, it would be rubbish. I hate that, you know, smell of the grease paint, roar of the crowd thing. But I do need an audience in front of me to be a stand-up. I've even tried sitting in the house and bantering with myself. Like I'm in,
thank you so like much I'm in for admitting a, that. Like Let's I'm in talk
a,
about
like
that.
I'm in a pub or something. Because also I hate the myth that stand-ups are all these weird auteurs and we should do everything on our own. I love collaborating. I've been in sketch groups and I've written in sketch groups. And being in a room with another comic, one of the two comics, that's the funnest part of comedy. Bouncing off each other and developing an idea together. I hate the idea that we're all like in our garrets wearing three coats because we can't afford to have the heating on at a typewriter. I think that's not... I mean, some people function like that, but I don't. I'm quite a sociable person and I would like... I just like writing with other people. It's much
more
fun.
I mean, the difference between thinking of an idea on your own and wondering if it's funny and then doing that and immediately asking the person next to you who's a trusted friend whose opinion you respect, and then they say, yeah, and they just say one little tweak on it and it sends you off down a completely different path.
Yes, completely,
Why would you not want to work
The
like
king
that?
Of this is Henry Packer. If you take anything to him, he will give you an angle that is from such a bizarre place and suddenly it will be a great routine. And it's just one fresh angle. And he is so good at that.
Yes. But I saw his Edinburgh show this year. Did you see it?
No, I didn't.
His most recent show was a kind of quite a daft, well, a very daft, a very Packerish kind of cartoon involving elements of cartoon and a story. One of the characters in it, and apologies, Henry, for butchering this, but one of the characters in it was, I think he was, what's it, like a bone, not a chiropractor, the other one.
A podiatrist, an osteopath.
Osteopath. But I see where you, there. It was an osteopath, and in order to preserve his perfect alignment, he only ever did things symmetrically. And that is just like, I could literally, you could put a gun to my head, I couldn't come up with that.
Yeah, no, he's, I did the Comedy Zone with him in 2008, and I got to know him really well, and I used to watch his set every night, because it made me laugh so much. And spending time with him socially, he is the funniest person in a... And that was another thing I loved about comedy was... Or getting into stand-up was I suddenly met a lot of people more talented than I was. And that is, if you're not, if you don't have hang-ups about it, is exhilarating. And it was just fun.
So this is Ellis. Now, listen, the first thing to say is that we spoke, and Ellis and I love a chat. I love a chat, Ellis loves a chat. So there is at least another, I mean, I think it's 35, 40 minutes of extras available on this one. And you can download that from comedianscomedian.com/extras, simply by signing up to the mailing list. Ellis will be talking about how and why he swerved the usual unhappiness pitfalls in stand-up. And he'll be talking about the difficulty of finding jeopardy in his autobiographical stuff now that he is a settled dad and partner. So, you know, things that are close to a lot of our hearts, I know. But really, really good stuff. So if you're enjoying this, as I'm sure you are, there is more stuff available from Ellis. comedianscomedian.com/extras. Now, before we get back to Ellis, I'm on holiday at the moment, but I'm getting back from holiday soon, and then a raft of really exciting stuff is happening. Obviously, the 23rd of January at Soho Theatre sees Ellis James and John Robbins join me for a sort of triple pod smash special live show, where I'll be interviewing them both at once, specifically about their brilliant Radio X Radio Show, and I'm fairly certain that sold out. There were four or five tickets left just before Christmas. I'd be staggered if it hadn't sold out, but you might get a return. Legittosohotheatre.com, where you can also find out the date, but not yet the guests, for the other Comedians Comedian Soho specials, which are on a couple of different months, non-sequential, but all coming up in the first half of next year. I've done it the first time. That's like the first time you write 16 instead of 17. I mean the first half of this year. So more stuff from Ellis, more stuff in the extras. Come and see Ellis's show. There's so much on at the moment. Listen, I'm going to talk to you about the slightly emotional post-amble for such as the Waffle Bin rebranded. I'm going to talk to you in the post-amble of this show about that one. So I won't say anything about that then, apart from thank you, if you're anyone that responded to that, as hundreds of you did. I'm really, really staggered by that. Thank you. But here are, I just wanted to read out, if you'll indulge me, some of your thoughts on An Hour, which was the Christmas gift, the much touted Christmas gift that I uploaded. Basically, I uploaded my show, the last touring show, not the one I'm touring in the next. God, like 3 weeks from now, that tour begins. Not that show. This is my Edinburgh show from 2015, which I toured in the spring of 2016. It's called An Hour. And here are some things that people said. James said, I want to talk about the current state of my knees after part of your show. I can't remember what it was now. It made me lose the power of my legs and I stumbled down quite heavily onto the floor laughing and whimpering. Lol. Now, you don't need to put lol there, James. but thanks, man. I've physically made someone fall over. That was a good start. That was one of the first reactions I received to that show. Paul says, I'm not one for immithering strangers. Immithering? I mean, I know mithering, but immithering? Is that a typo, or am I just not as genned up on the Mancunian language as I thought I was? He said, I thought I'd say thanks for the Christmas gift of your Hour stand-up podcast. On the back of this, I'll be booking for your Manchester date in 2017. That's exactly how we want it done. Julia says, wanted to say thanks for the recent bonus episode of your stand-up show. This is sweet. Julia says, hard to know how to say how much we enjoyed it without sounding patronising. That is not a thing that troubles me. Patronise away. If you love the show, please tell me. She says, we'd already discovered your other stand-up show online in the summer. Tickets have now been purchased to see you live in May. Oliver says it's effing hilarious. That's, I've changed that bleep. He said fucking, but I changed it, made it sound nicer. Toby said, I loved every minute, made my day. Chris says, as a pod listener since show 8, can I say how much I enjoyed listening to the latest one, a really top rate stand up set. Andrew says, wank off the milk monkey, genius. And you will of course have to download the album itself to get into that. Excellent Spaniard Paco said, your secret gift is probably the best thing anyone's ever given me. Now that's too much. that's too much, man. Come on, get some better friends. That's my advice to Paco. David says, love the Hour, thanks for putting it up. Adam says, I've listened to your podcast, but I haven't heard any of your stand-up. You're now my favourite comic. I mean, again, come on, get out more. I'm good, right? But thank you, I appreciate it. And finally, a little thing from Andy. Thanks for the gift this morning. This is a different Andy, there was one earlier. Thanks for the gift this morning. As it's the season of goodwill, I would like to return the gesture. He gave me a little donation. He said, this is not for the podcast, but more for the stand-up show. Whilst I believe the podcast has a value, I just want to respect the amount of effort you put into a 1 hour show and help fund the day job too. Hey, Andy, good point. I'm not soliciting donations for the stand-up show. Some of you have very kindly said, oh, you know, this is what I would have paid for a ticket or what have you, and you've sent me little donations. I've written some sizable ones as well. Very much appreciate those. But if you would like to pay, if you missed the thing, if you're new, if you're listening 5 years from now and you missed the thing, then on my website, you can discover the album in a lot of different places. But if you buy it at comedianscomedian.com/shop, then that links directly to my page on Bandcamp, which I think is comedianscomedian.com, but I'm not sure. The point is, go via comedianscomedian.com/shop. I get the best return. I think it's cheaper there for you, and I make more money than if you buy it more expensively somewhere else. Do you understand? More money. I mean, like £3.82 per copy, I think, but you can pay more if you like. So if you missed it, then please feel free to purchase a copy, and if you received it and emailed me to say thank you, or simply if you enjoyed it privately, thank you so much. I loved making that show. I loved performing it. I've got so many happy memories of that Edinburgh run and the tour, and I did my first interview this year for the spring tour only a couple of days ago with Becky Golding in South Bristol, and I know she's on episode number 32, so hello Becky for several years from now. She's catching up, and I did an interview about the tour, and she said, oh, that's a lot of dates, it's something like 55 dates, how are you including some Australian dates as well, and she said, how are you feeling about it? And I was like, yeah, it's a lot of dates, right? That's the bigger tour as I've ever done. It's like doing slightly more than two Edinburghs in a row, but thank God, I love the show. It's such a fun show to do, and I have so many exciting experiences of performing it, of tweaking as you go. There's all of that stuff for me to find, you know. There's like the show it was at Edinburgh by the end of the beginning of the festival. There's the show it was by the end of the festival. And then there's the show it will be on day one of the tour. And then there's the show it will be on and the end. You know, there's just so much to explore and play around with that. So that's all of that. That's a thank you for I've just been wanking off the milk monkey there. Many apologies, and apologies for apologizing with it via a reference to a thing only some of you will understand. But I gave away tens of thousands of copies of that. So thanks for listening to it. That felt like a really good thing to do. So that's all of that. If you want any information about the tour, which I've banged on about enough, but it's comedianscomedian.com/tour. But if you are in any of the following places or near any of the following places, you can come and see me. A very quick list. Joker's Comedy in Southend, Lighthouse in Poole, Gulbenkian Cafe in Canterbury, The Criterion in Leicester, The Hawth in Crawley, Comedia Brighton, XS Malarkey in Manchester, Whelan's in Dublin, Exeter Bikeshed, The Widcombe Social Club in Bath, Harrogate Theatre, Birmingham Glee, Fruit in Hull, Henry Tudor House in Shrewsbury, Hen and Chick in Bristol, Stand in Glasgow, The Stand in Newcastle, Hilarity Bites in Darlington, The Leeds Wardrobe, The Melbourne International Comedy Festival, yep. I'm officially announcing that. The West End Centre in Aldershot, the Macclesfield Comedy Festival, the Northampton Royal in Durngate, the Junction in Cambridge, the Lescar in Sheffield, Chapter Arts in Cardiff, Hemel Hempstead's Old Town Hall, Warwick Arts Centre in Coventry, and then culminating in a full week in the downstairs venue at the Soho Theatre in London at the end of May, beginning of June. So that's a lot of stuff coming up. If you're near any of those places, comedianscomedian.com/tour. Come and see me. Bring five friends. Got a lot of tickets to sell. Let's get back to Ellie.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So let's just stay with this idea of your concern about relevancy, because you sent me that link, that very, very funny story, which I don't think I'd heard before, of paintballing on a come down.
Right,
that
yeah.
bit that you did on Dave's one night stand.
Yeah.
And we were talking about that, and you said that you didn't think that you could write anything like that again, or you were concerned that you couldn't, because it was to do with, it wasn't the comedy of a dad.
No.
It was a young person who could go out and get trolleyed. And
if you're an anecdotalist or a storyteller, you live and die by your reveals and also by the jeopardy in your story. And the more settled your life becomes, the less jeopardy you have. So John Robbins, who I do the radio show with, is the most punctual human being I have ever met. So when he was late for one show, we thought he was dead. So we called his girlfriend, and because we thought he must have died.
And you started the show as he was coming in, and you were texting him. Yeah.
Whereas if I was late, it's Ellis is late. No one thinks that I've crashed a car. People think I've got up late.
Okay.
And in my 20s, I was single for most of my 20s, so I used to go out a lot and I used to get drunk and I was a complete idiot and I was constantly late. And when you're living your life by those margins, things go wrong, and things going wrong, that is funny. And being single is funny. So this, most people want to see it obviously, but as a precy of that paintballing routine,
which is available on YouTube if anyone wants to have a go.
I went out and I took ecstasy and I had forgotten that I was going paintballing the next day. So then my friends woke me up at 9 a.m. and said, "We're going paintballing now." And I went, and it was absolutely horrendous. It was the worst day of my life, because obviously I was on a come down and all that sort of stuff. And it was a fairly easy routine to write because you've got all the jeopardies there.
Yeah.
And then because I was there all day, and I was there with groups of people I didn't know, and the instructors are a certain type of person. If you go paintballing, you'll know. That allowed me to do different characters, and it allowed me to go off on tangents, allowed me to do observational stuff about the people I was with and the instructors, and how absurd paintballing is when you live a sort of a cosseted Western 21st century existence, how ridiculous the idea of simulating war with paint. So it allowed me to do all these things, but then you get to a certain age and you get tired of people rolling their eyes at you because you fucked up. So
you get tired of audiences, or do you mean in your real life?
In my real life, I got tired of people going, oh, yeah, well, of course Ellis is late. And rolling their eyes, well, of course he hasn't done that. Of course he hasn't filled that form in. Of course he hasn't got travel insurance for the gigs he's doing in New Zealand. Of course he hasn't. And then you get to a stage where you think, well, actually... I have.
So
but when you sort your
life out... You get into fewer scrapes because you've sorted your life out.
You get into fewer scrapes.
This tallies really... I think this is very interesting because I said on the podcast a while ago about a really useful writing... Not an exercise, but like a little sideline thing to do. When you're writing, Pete Dobbing put me onto this. You keep a tally chart at the back of the book in which you're writing. Every time you think to yourself one of your negative things that's going to stop you writing, like, oh, I've used up all my stories.
Yeah.
You think... I'm congratulating myself on that. I've another tick, and you literally have a column marked,
right.
You know, I've used up all my stories. Or you have a column marked, I just can't do this. Or a column marked, I can't concentrate on this today. And so rather than ruminate on that negative thing, you just put a thing in the tally and you get on with it. Now, I'm sorry, I'll let you interrupt me in a minute. Otherwise, I'm going to forget my thread. Because one of the things that I think most frequently, one of the biggest columns for me, one of the most frequently filled ones, is...
You're too handsome.
Never bothers me. One of the columns for me is, I'm a problem solver. I don't get into scrapes. When things go wrong, I fix them. That's who I've always been. If my car gets a flat tire, I enjoy setting the timer. I time myself as to how quickly I can solve the problem and get back on the road.
Okay.
So that is the, I think to myself, or I used to, that is the opposite of a stand-up comedian. This is why I'm no good. So it's fascinating to hear someone almost corroborate that idea.
Well, don't get me wrong. It's a much more pleasant life. It is a far less exciting life.
The enemy of material.
I know where my passport is. And that is, telling 25, it could have been absolutely anywhere when I was 25. I know where my driving license is. I could tell you in one email who provides my home insurance. But I didn't have home insurance. I didn't have any of that stuff. I just didn't, it didn't seem relevant or... I just didn't know anything. But when you're bouncing from one crisis to another, which was what my 20s was, it is easy to write material then. So what I would do is the Welsh language show, the interesting thing with being bilingual is that I have a slightly different personality in Welsh to what I do in English. And my onstage persona was different. So the...
You have a different personality?
Yes, I'd say so.
Okay. You've got to explain further about anything about that.
For instance... There's this thing called the Eisteddfod.
Is one of you really angry?
The Eisteddfod is this big cultural festival where people recite poems and they sing songs and it's quite old-fashioned. It's the biggest youth cultural festival in Europe. And we were forced to do it at school and I hated every second of it. My two sisters loved it and performed for years and we used to traipse around the country watching them. And they would sing in choirs and things, or mini choirs of seven or eight. And they did it because they were with their friends. And I now, as a 36-year-old, understand that they were just hanging out with their mates and getting the adrenaline performing, and it was just a bit of fun. Whereas I was this NME reading, Melody Maker reading, quite sneering teenager. I just thought it was uber lame. So I was always taking the piss out of that stuff. And then because I think I'd done a lot of stand-up in English in England, all of the marketing around the Welsh shows that he's a popular British comic in English and now he's coming back and doing a show in his first language. And it allowed me to be quite sneering and damning about stuff and say, this is rubbish, in a way that I probably wouldn't in English. And I was probably higher status, I would say, in Welsh than I was in English.
Okay.
Because I'd moved away and I was taking the piss.
Within that culture, even
within
if you
that
physically
culture.
Hadn't moved that far, you'd moved away and come back.
Yeah.
So you were here to tell
and
everybody.
And also a lot of the first 5 minutes of that show were the gigs. There's no real Welsh language circuit yet. There will be, but... So the gigs, I did one gig in a shop. And there was no mic or anything. And I turned up and the manager of the shop was like, oh, looking forward to having you. And I said, great. I said, so where's the stage? And he went, no stage. And I said, where's the mic? And he went, well, there's no mic, but I thought you could just lean against the till. But I had to do the gig. And I said, how many are we expecting? And he said, an absolute definite dozen. We are definitely getting a dozen, possibly 13. But they were all, bar a couple of examples, Aberystwyth Arts Centre, that was a good one, and the one in Carmarthen went well, and the one in Swansea, but barring a few examples, it was a real hodgepodge. It was probably like doing stand-up about 30 years ago when it was a nascent thing and there was only about 20 comics.
Okay.
But as someone who worked in Australia and New Zealand and England and all sorts, it allowed me to go, what is, come on, Wales? And Welsh people will have the piss taken out of them by a Welsh person.
Yes.
So I was higher, it allowed me to be higher status.
So going back to that story, the paintballing story, you mentioned that as a storyteller, you live or die by your reveals
and
by your jeopardy.
Yeah.
Now, I get what you mean from the jeopardy. Because people can, if super nerdy fans of this show, which is all of you, can go and watch that on YouTube, on Dave's One Night Stand. And what for you are the reveals in that piece of material?
Well, spoiler alert, I turned up without any money because I was awake at, I was asleep at 8:58 and then I was in the car by 9:01. So I only had a t-shirt on and it was raining and I only had a pair of tracksuit bottoms on and I didn't have any money and you've got to pay for your bullets. So I couldn't even pay for it.
And that's true,
so
you said, because my mates are bastards.
I didn't have any bullets, so I couldn't even fire back.
So they made you go paintballing and no one would lend you.
It was like being a kid again. So I couldn't shoot it anywhere, and this doesn't make it into the routine, but we were told at the start you're not allowed to shoot someone from point blank range because that's potentially dangerous. So if you go up behind someone, you say surrender, then you say surrender, and then you're out of the game. You walk to the dead zone. The language of it is absurd. Dead zone, cordoned off, bit next to some bat, and I was hidden behind a barrel in the rain, clutching a redundant gun, and then a bloke came up to me on a stag do and he went, surrender! And I hadn't been listening during the initial sort of lecture, so I just said, I don't know what you want from me, which allowed him to then shoot me in the back from about. And just everything kept going wrong, and my mask steamed up because it was raining, and I was hungover, so I was breathing heavily. So I was also blind.
So what work did you need to do? I mean, is that story maybe a bad example of the craft of storytelling because it was all there for you?
A better one, actually, is when my friends were about 18, they decided to go carol singing to make some money.
I'm far more familiar with this bit. Yeah. I've seen you do this many times.
So they decided to go carol singing to make some money, but it was way too early. It was September or something. And they only knew one line of one carol, which was Silent Night, Holy Night. And then, so they made nothing. And they were trying to buy money for weed. And then they turned up at a pensioner's house and he invited them in under the premise that he could make requests because he loved carols being sung. So they thought, brilliant, we might get some money out of this. So he requested Last Christmas by Wham. They sang it, but the guy whose idea it was knew far more of the song than his mates because his stepsister's older than him and she really liked Wham. So suddenly then he started singing it solo. Verses that no one's heard, but it looked pre-planned, and then they came back into the chorus. And when I got told that story, it was absolutely the funniest thing I'd ever heard in my life. And I tried to make it work for ages on stage, and I couldn't. And then I realised I had to be involved.
You had to be there. It's a story about you failing,
I had
isn't
to
it?
Be involved. So I wasn't the main protagonist, but I was the other person who didn't know the words, and then that allowed me to observe what's going on.
Okay,
and when you're writing a story for stand-up, you want to get the ball rolling, and then once they're really laughing, I don't mind waiting a minute to do some setup if it's a nice gig. If I think so, I wouldn't do that one story at a weekend club probably because the setup's slightly too long. So I don't think they'll go with me at a weekend club.
Okay.
Although I will be trying to work out, because it's my favourite bit, I'll be trying to work that out during the first 15 minutes of the set. So if I think they'll go with it, I'll chuck
sort
it in
of gauging
at the end.
The elasticity. Almost.
Yeah, for quarter of an hour, especially if I'm opening or in the middle, I'll think I might be able to get away with this. So then you want to get the momentum rolling. It's a bit like pushing a snowball down a hill. Once they're really laughing, then you really want to sort of turn the screw and make it as funny as possible. And the thing with that Wham story was, what was very funny was the pensioner had respiratory problems. So if I could, doing a impression of him enjoying it would always get a laugh. So if there was ever a lull, I could chuck that in again. And I can't do straight up observational comedy like Josh can in English. I can in Welsh. I don't know why that is. So, but I can drop it into a story. So I've got a story about weeing in a swimming pool when I was 2 or 3. And halfway through the story, when the jeopardy's at its height, because my father's pulled me out of the swimming pool and people are screaming and there's piss everywhere and the lifeguard's shouting at me, that then allows me to do observational material about swimming pools. But because I've built up a head of steam by this point, I am able to almost come out of it and be exasperated. And it's like almost like a checklist of things that we're adding to the situation that are just general observations on what a swimming pool is like. But if I went on stage and said, swimming pools, why is there a vendor... that I can't seem to get away with. And it's to do with comic voice, I think. I don't know why that is, but I've never been able to work that out.
Go on. It's to do with comic voice, which is that what you're... I mean, let's look at some possibilities for that, because that's really... When everyone says, I can't work it out, I'm like, let's try and get it.
So I did an hour of greatest hits, if you will. My favourite routines at the Machynlleth Comedy Festival.
Yes.
So an hour, it was probably eight stories, maybe.
Uh-huh.
And I noticed that the funniest ones, there will be jeopardy that has come from real life. I'm unable to make that up for some reason. And that is something I wish I was able to, because then I could write it like it was a novel.
Yeah.
But for people to buy it, and if people don't buy it, if people don't think it's true, they absolutely won't laugh. And I've never been able to sit down and come up with a reveal that makes sense. So I need the jeopardy to come from real life. And then once the reveal is funny enough, I can work back and then tell the story. And then once I've got the framework of it, I can chuck in observations, which might be things I've just thought for ages, or the things I realise as I'm writing the bit.
So
know what I mean.
Do you think it's to do with the strength of the observations that you can't just deliver them?
It might well be that.
Or is it that
it probably
you're...
is actually, because I think a really good observation, like James Acaster, there are no more observations to be made about mariachi music because James has made every single one.
Yeah.
And if you take any of the things James has done observation material on, he's rinsed it. And I can't rinse a topic like James can, but if they're already laughing at the absurd situation I'm in, my observation about, I don't know, those little pools that stop you getting verrucas will be a topper onto what is already happening. And then that will give me the momentum to make it a funny enough bit to be performable.
And so how does comic voice play into that? Do you feel that in English you have a less...
I just
of a,
don't,
of a
I,
kind of
I don't think
strong
I have,
or a defined
I
comic
don't
voice.
Think I have angles that are as fresh as James's or any of the great observationalists. And thus, I think people... For instance, right, I did a lot of circuit work in about 2011, 2012. I did a lot of weekend clubs. So I did a lot of the Glee and Up the Creek and the Comedian, all that sort of stuff. And I got John Gordillo to direct my 2012 show. And I'd lived with him in 2008 and he'd been to see the 2009 one, but I hadn't seen him for a bit. And doing the Comedian Up the Creek and all of those gigs, what that had done was it had smartened me up. So I was going on at Edinburgh wearing the clothes I would wear to do the Comedian on a Saturday night. And John came to the first one and he said, what are you doing? You look like you're going on a date.
Okay.
Have you shaved? I was like, yeah. He's like, what is wrong? No. You've cut your hair. What? No, whoa. He said, that is not what people want from you at all. He said, the Ellis I knew when I lived with you in Edinburgh a few years ago, and the first, and the you know, when we did lots of gigs together, was this scruffy, ridiculous person who can't quite believe he's got to the gig on time. But now you look like you're about to take someone to ZZ's for a meal. What is this? And it hadn't occurred to me. And I think one of the challenges for writing material in the future is that because I've settled down a bit and I know where my passport is, I don't really know what I should look like.
Yes, that's interesting to have come across.
I don't know what clothes
a,
I should wear anymore.
A touchstone for who am I?
Because the other thing is, like any young parent, and also because I'm quite laid back, my default setting is it will be fine. And occasionally I mess up because I think it will be fine when it doesn't, and actually she needs to eat and she can't stand there because it's dangerous or whatever. But it's difficult to do that stuff because if an audience think you're putting your kid in danger, they don't laugh. They think about calling social services. And so I wrote after she was born, I wrote probably... 30 minutes of stuff. Some stuff I thought was really funny, but if the jeopardy was on the baby rather than myself, then it's not funny at all. So one of my great regrets is that I was hungover at the birth of my daughter by mistake. I went out and got drunk by mistake because Izzy tapped her stomach and said, "This baby isn't coming anytime soon. Please go out with your friends." And I only had a couple, but, you know, that's a regret of mine. I tried that story at a new material night, and especially the women I found thought, "Oh, that's great. So she's 9 months pregnant and you're in the pub." And even though it was very funny for my friends, I don't think it's a performable routine. I got happy slapped in a shop by 14-year-old girls, one of whom is in a wheelchair, and I cannot make that funny on stage because, I don't know, I've never been able to work that out. Because I got mugged in Cardiff and I got beaten up, but that I can make funny.
So is it to do with who the victim is? So if you got happy slapped in a shop by some girls, does the wheelchair make it not funny?
Yeah, because I remember I don't lose my temper very often, but I did lose my temper and I chased them. But as I was chasing them, I was thinking, what am I going to do if I catch them? They're 5 15-year-old girls who've obviously done it for a day. What do I have available to me?
Yes.
Because I'm not going to start shouting like a teacher.
No, and I tell you what, if you were 28, that might be funnier because you'd have fewer options because you'd be a boy wanting to be
a
man.
It was ridiculous.
If you're in your 30s, in your late 30s maybe.
But then I was chasing them and I hadn't let go of my shopping because I'd done a lot of shopping and I thought if I lose the bags, if I lose my trolley, this is going to be a nightmare. I'll have to go around again. And also, it was quite half-hearted because I'd realised quite quickly I didn't have many options available to me. And then one of the friends caught me up on a wheelchair and said, "What are you going to do if you catch them?" And I was like, "I haven't got to that part yet."
Okay, well, that's interesting. That voice that you did just then.
Yeah.
That moment, that is a very Ellis thing.
Yeah.
And it's in a lot of your stand-up. I think that is like a small neurotic, or not neurotic, but a put-upon man.
Yeah.
Angry, but
because powerless. I'm physically small as well, so it's difficult for me to show my temper without looking absurd. So yes. When I do that voice, because if I was, you know, 6'5", then me losing my temper is a completely different ball game, but I am 5'6", so when I lose my temper, it's sort of hilarious, unless I've got a weapon.
Just to get really specific on the writing, something that I noticed from one of your bits I saw on YouTube in the last week or so, you use the word seldom on stage, and it suddenly struck me that you're the only comedian I've ever heard or could ever imagine using the word seldom on stage. And I just wanted to talk about your use of language.
Right.
And earlier on, you described something as doggerel. Right. I thought, yeah, I can imagine you saying doggerel during a routine as well.
One of my favourite things to do, this was a lot of fun in Welsh as well, is I will occasionally write out a routine longhand. And then I'll put all the words into a thesaurus.
Ooh, and here's the good stuff.
And the thing with the thesaurus, it is an extraordinary tool. Because the reason words like seldom and doggerel are funny is that you know what they mean, but you'd never use them.
Yes, they're almost an observational joke in themselves.
Yeah, they're not quite on the tip of your tongue. They're sort of halfway back.
I'm fascinated to hear that much thought went into your use of the word seldom.
Well, I think with seldom, it was I was hanging out with a slightly older man from Carmarthen who used to use it, and I just thought it was amazing. Stuart Lee's got this thing about Richard Herring. I think, isn't Richard Herring's dad a vicar?
Yes. Oh, no, teacher, who's a headmaster.
Yeah, but Richard will use words that are quite biblical sometimes.
Yes.
And it's just like humble is quite a funny word. And the reason I took my friend on tour with me is that he's got this wonderful, he had a very, very chapel religious upbringing and his parents read the Bible a lot and he's got this very biblical Welsh language turn of phrase, which is at the back of everyone's tongue, if we're going to continue this analogy, because everyone went to Sunday school, but no one goes to chapel anymore. So you think, oh, you might not have heard that word since you were 10 or 11, but you'll know what it means. And then that's just funny.
Yes,
and the thing with the thesaurus is that you could put the word extra in, and then the first one will be additional, and then there'll be another seven or eight. And the fifth one, the seventh and the eighth ones will be words you've never heard before, but the fifth one would be like, oh, yes, then I'll use that word. But if I'm doing a weekend gig and I think that they're too drunk,
you'll shift three gears back on the thesaurus.
Yeah, I'll go back to the front of the tongue. And I can do that because in the same way that you modify your speech depending on who you're talking to, I think we talk differently on the radio show to how I would if I was doing a radio show on a different station, because I think Radio X listeners will buy into it. And certainly at the live gigs they did. And John absolutely doesn't hold back. And I think the exciting thing with the tour was it allowed us to use those words, because they're not, you know, I'm not talking about Chaucer or Shakespeare. They're 21st century words. They're just not your first port of call.
It's funny you should mention Chaucer. John, in the interview on this podcast with him, used the phrase to quite someone. Yeah. And he said in the Chaucerian sense. And I thought, well, first appearance in nearly 200 episodes of Chaucerian.
Yeah, I just think a thesaurus is, because also it can work as a punchline almost. Like, I'm very bad at writing actual jokes. And I used to really, really beat myself up about this. So I would listen to Tim Vine and Milton Jones and Gary Delaney and Jimmy Carr, and I would try and work out the mechanics of a one-liner. But if it doesn't come naturally, if you hang out with Noel James, he just thinks in jokes.
Yes.
But I don't.
Yes, I worked with him recently, and I just said something to him. I can't remember what he came back with, but I said something to him like, oh, my brother-in-law's in the audience, and he just did a little one-line riff on it, like every sentence, but every conversation with him.
That's not the kind of brain you've been given.
Sure.
My brain, I work in characters and voices and stories. Like Robbins loves reading poetry, but I loved reading novels. Like, I never read poetry, but he will do that to relax, and he'll read T.S. Eliot to unwind, whereas I would read a novel. And it's just a slightly different way of... Your brain is wired. If you don't think in jokes, but then you try and teach yourself how to do it, the jokes you write are absolutely rubbish.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I think every non-one-liner comic has tried to find out whether they're a one-liner comic.
But then
comic.
I thought, what's the point? Because Billy Connolly never told jokes. He's just a funny guy in the pub. And then I thought, well, if that's me, then that's me. I just need to get punchy. You can always make an anecdote or a story punchier.
And I agree. What tools would you use in the first instance if you were like, I've got a bit of a... Like, have you got a thing at the moment, say, just
the
to bring
thing
it right I, into
the
now?
Thing with a story
is... What are you toying with at the
people
moment?
People don't laugh if they're confused. And people are confused if they don't quite understand the setup. So your setup has to be very, very clear. The situation that you are in, or your friends are in, or your daughter is in, has to be made very explicit early on so that everyone is on board. Or once they're on board, they will usually go with it. But you need to make that process as short as possible. And if possible, funny. So when I used to do Late in Live, because...
Which is a late night gig, is Edinburgh.
It's the latest
it's like
night, late night.
It starts at 1 a.m. or something?
Yeah, and it ends at 4. So the last Edinburgh I did, I was closing Late at Live occasionally. So you're on stage at 3:30 and they are hammered.
Yeah.
So to try and keep their attention, it is too late.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. I've done that gig many times.
I used to really love Spank, because Spank starts at 11 and they are as drunk, but it is 4 hours earlier in the evening. So what I used to do with Late in Live, and I used to do this when I used to do Jonglers and Highlights as well, was I don't mind doing a bit of crowd work. I would often not invite heckles, but I would invite stuff to happen in the audience, because I'm fairly confident I could deal with it. Because if you're as drunk as they are at 3:30, then we've got problems.
Yeah.
But if you can't deal with someone who's that drunk, then you've got problems as a comic. So I remember the last Late in Live I did, there was a South African bloke who'd been the centre of attention, and he'd been a very irritating heckler, and everyone had had to deal with him. So I think I pretended to invite him on stage, and I got everyone to cheer whether she'd be on stage or not. So that's waking everyone up. And then I invited him on stage, and I told him that he couldn't come on stage, and that was funny or whatever. It was quite cheap, actually. But still, I was sort of playing with him and toying with him, because he wanted to be played with, but I was confident I could make it funny. And if I was getting laughs, that would get everyone's attention. So then after about 10 minutes, I was doing 15 minutes. I said, right, you've got to sit down now. And I think I made everyone give him a round of applause. And because it had worked, I then said, if I tell you a 5-minute story, will you listen? And then they all cheered. And then it's like resetting the gig to 9:00. So when I used to do Jonglers and Highlights and stuff, because they can be quite rowdy, I used to try and engineer a mini happening. and then I would sort of ask, is it rope-a-dope or something? Is what some comics call it. And then I would ask for a bit of leeway to tell a longer bit.
That's a boxing expression, and I don't know what it means.
Muhammad Ali in, was it The Rumble in the Jungle? He was leaning against the ropes, knowing he could cope with a lot of...
Okay.
Blows to the body.
You let them wear themselves out.
Let George Foreman wear himself out.
Okay.
And then he won in the 10th or something because he had plenty of gas left in the tank. But the problem with that is it's very tiring and high risk. So sometimes, and I will freely admit this, it went very, very wrong. And sometimes I would always just try and do my set, but it was a thing I knew I could do at the rowdier gigs if I had to. But I never really enjoyed doing it because it's high risk. And I did used to think I would sort of just prefer it if you listened. Because why are we doing this? You've all paid. But you've got to play the gig you're faced with.
What are you doing now in terms of stand-up? What material were you doing on tour with John?
Well, with
were the, you doing tried
the
and
tour
tested
with
stuff?
John was all stuff that was based on the show.
Okay.
So I would go out and I would do 2 minutes of crowd work, and then John would have his very big introduction.
Yes.
And then
I saw a version of it.
And then it was stuff from the show and things that fans from the show would recognise. When I do stand-up now, if I do the circuit, I do about 10 minutes of quite new stuff about the baby because that's me at the moment.
Yeah.
And then I will end on 10 minutes of old, old stuff.
Okay.
Because you've got to give them their 20 minutes worth. I've got about 50 minutes of stuff that if I had Edinburgh as a deadline, could be worked up to be a funny enough hour. But because I only really... I do a lot of other... I do acting and other things now on the radio show, and it's bubbling under, but it's I haven't really got the time to devote to go into new material night. So I looked at my diary from the last Edinburgh show, and May, June, July was just previews and new material nights. But I'm not in the position to do that. It's taken a sort of a slight backseat stand-up at the moment. I would love to write a stand-up show with someone else.
Oh.
But I don't think you're allowed to.
By whom?
The comedy.
No, no. And I think there is no comedy.
It's
you're allowed
it's
to do
an interesting
whatever you want.
One because
you might find that you're not eligible for an award.
Yeah.
Other than that, there is no award. A writer
who does a lot of monologue gags for TV shows and gag passes on other people's scripts. He told me once that he would love to take a young act who's good at crowd work and
give them some gear
and basically
work with them
create a comedian, him and a couple of other writers. So
now we can play the game of it's already happened, which comic was it?
But you know, take someone who's got a good 20 and people are talking about, you know, agents are sniffing around, and then basically create a comic. I wrote on Stand Up for the Week, and I've written with other, I was in a sketch group called Super Clump with 8 other comics.
I remember it was ludicrous.
And it was
Nat
Lertzmer, Tom
Wozniak.
Crane, Wozniak, Harry Packer, Ben Partridge,
yes,
Sean Harris, Josh Widdicombe, me, Henry Widdicombe. How many is that? Is that
I mean, that's already more than 9, I think.
And it was such fun. And people used to say, well, you only have to write 5 minutes each. But actually, it wasn't that. Your stuff had to get past 8 people.
Yes, that's
so. But hanging out with other comics and make, especially if your peer group and your friends and who make you laugh is the most fun thing. And I just would like John Gordillo directed my show in 2012. But if Gordillo directs you, he won't give you jokes or toppers.
No.
He will talk about structure and he'll dismantle your personality.
Yes,
he'll put you back to put you back
but
to,
why,
again.
Why are you?
Why
up
you?
There? Yeah.
But I just think it's just a healthy, fun thing to do, and I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I also think that when you're not devoted to Edinburgh, a lot of stuff happens that you could get stuff out of that, and you forget and you pass it by. So I occasionally look at old Facebook statuses and think, oh yeah. The one thing I would love to do, but I haven't got the time, is John and I have done, I don't know, 140 podcasts or something. And there is definitely loads of material there.
Yes.
Stuff, because we talk about our week. So that's, you know, every week from 2014, February, whatever it was, to present until we get sacked. It's a treasure trove of the last 3 years of my experience. I just haven't got the patience to sit through 140 of my own podcasts.
Well, I mean, feel free to tell me to cut this, but you know, I know where you can find roughly 1,000 people who would be happy to do that for you.
There's nothing like a deadline. And for 2012, I had nothing in April. And then by the end of July, it was probably the best show I'd done because of fear. Because it was the highest profile I'd been in Edinburgh, so I was expecting you know, press and all that sort of stuff.
And fear is a good, that's like a deadline in itself, isn't it? That's a deadline.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot to be said about that stress, actually, I think. I know that it's, you know, having a bad Edinburgh is a horrendous experience. But if Stuart Lee said in The Observer or something, or The Guardian, that stand-ups who don't do it ossify and stagnate, I know what he means, because I'd stopped enjoying Edinburgh. No, I'd stopped enjoying stand-up because I was doing 10 from my 2012 and 10 from my 2011 at circuit gigs. I wasn't getting anything out of it because I always thought that what I enjoyed was the performance, and it isn't. So I thought, well, this is me done. I'm going to quit stand-up because I'm not having fun anymore. And then I got given the hour on S4C to write a Welsh language show. So I've never done gigs in Welsh before. First language, never done gigs in it, really. So now I've got 3 months to write an hour and a half that's good enough for television. So suddenly, every single conversation I have is potentially material. So every single conversation I have with my parents, I was writing stuff down as I was on the phone to my mum and dad. Because my dad especially is very funny. So
okay.
I'm trying to get something, and I did 13 previews, and the show wasn't really funny till probably the fifth or the sixth one. And then I did one in Swansea in front of about 50 people, and it went quite well. And I drove back to London, and I was punching the ceiling of the car because I was so happy. Because A, it's a very emotional, evocative thing to do, stand up in your first language when you haven't done it before.
Yes.
You feel like you're just unlocking a door to everything.
Yes.
And also, I could see the show taking shape. And I came off stage and I shook hands with the producer, and he said, "We're going to be fine. We're going to be fine. That was great. We're going to be fine." And I said, "How long was it?" He said, "You did an hour and nine. We're going to be fine." So I drove back. It's about 3.5 hours, and I was beeping the horn.
Yes.
Because I thought it's going to be fine.
Okay.
And I've just come up with this hour. And then the next one was, it was in Felinfach, which is a very Welsh-speaking part of Wales, and they've got a theatre devoted to Welsh language stuff. So it had sold out. And that's where a lot of my family are from. So I knew I could push certain buttons. And again, I drove back to my mum and dad's house, punching the roof of the car, thinking, this is it. And by that stage, I was thinking, well, if I'm a stand-up, this is what I'm meant to do. You're meant to turn over stuff. That is what the point of being a stand-up is. It's not to do the same gear for 10 years because it pays your mortgage. It's to come up with new, better jokes. And I've realised that I haven't fallen out of love with stand-up. I've fallen out of love with doing old material.
Doing the same old stuff, yes.
So okay. I'm writing another Welsh show, and I've got this iPhone note that I back up because I'm in my 30s, not in my 20s. And it's just every idea. So I haven't done the first preview, which will probably be in Machynlleth, but it's this huge document. And then I will work on that in the run-up to try and work out which is the most performable stuff. And I think the key to that is that my daughter has such a different upbringing to the one I had. That is where the humour will lie, I think.
Okay. That, to me, is the sound of an experienced comic going, okay, I know what the key to that show is.
Because
will be.
There is a big thing in Welsh language culture about authenticity, which I think we need to get over, actually. So I speak Welsh to my daughter, but because she goes to a toddler group in South London, she has a broad Cockney accent. So when she speaks Welsh back to me, it sounds like Dennis Waterman has lived in Aberystwyth. And this is really funny. And it's quite funny in English, actually. I've done it in English at New Material Nights, but in Welsh, that is, I can see, I'm quite confident that's going to fly. And also, she has quite a very middle-class sort of toddlery upbringing. Like, she eats avocados and mango. I didn't try mango until I was about 25. And she goes to this thing called Fox Tots, where it's a band and they sing songs about the importance of brushing your teeth. And it's in a community centre in Penge. And she goes to Soft Play. Like, Soft Play didn't exist when I was her age. And I think the contrast of her life with my upbringing, and what most people's upbringings were like in Wales, is the key to the next show, because I will be able to talk about myself and her, and it will just allow me to bring in characters that don't usually get heard on Welsh language telly. So I think that's the key to it. And I'm all, because also, because she's bilingual, she mixed her first sentence was a mix of English and Welsh.
Oh my God.
But then it's really funny. So her first sentence was, she saw sheep live for the first time on a holiday in Suffolk. And boyd is the Welsh word for food. So she went, "Oi, Baba!" at the sheep.
what are you doing eating, Boyd?
And she was just asking, the sheep if it was eating food or not, but she said Boyd rather than food. And it's just, I think a Welsh audience will go for that. I'm fairly confident they will anyway. I hope so. If not, I've got to go back to the drawing board and I'm running out of time. But that's the new...
But that's a good position to be.
Yeah, but that's the new exciting thing, I think.
I'm just going to wrap up with some quick fire questions. This is a new thing.
Okay.
This is a new thing. Which comic would it be most narratively satisfying if they killed you?
If they killed Robbins.
I mean, it had to be. which bit of someone else's, and it could be a one-liner or an extended bit or a story, which one bit do you most wish that you'd written?
Well, I wish the character I'd come up with was Alan Partridge. Because it's the greatest comic creation of all time, I think. But as one bit, oh, I don't know, there's too many. I love watching comedy. And also, I love watching my friends perform. So if you watch Henry Packer or Robbins or Josh Widdicombe, they're going to be really, really funny. And so I often sit there and they've all got different skills to me. Or Acaster. Like, I look at Acaster and I just think, how are you doing this?
Yeah. He comes up a lot on this show.
Yeah.
Specifically, that sentiment. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I do lots of charity gigs with Dan Kitson. He often won't have done stand-up for 3 months or 6 months.
Yeah.
And then I just think, you're different.
Seeing him do a preview and arrive at the gig and whilst getting ready to perform, tell a story about a conversation he'd had over the phone 2 hours previously for 40 minutes and then say, and it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And then he said, oh, we better have an interval, actually, and then we'll do the preview.
Yeah. Is he... I used to do a thing called a committee meeting. We used to do a show at the Muni Arts Centre in Pontypridd every couple of months. So we used to write a show from scratch. And then we'd always get, just in case the show was bad, we used to get a headliner in case, just so people couldn't complain and have money back. And we got Izzy to do it. And she wrote a song about Pontypridd. And it was just the right amount of observations on the town, which were cheeky enough to be funny, but charming enough to get away with.
Yeah.
And I did think, bearing in mind she's written that today, that is pretty impressive.
What most holds you back?
I was super, super bashful as a young act, and I hated calling for gigs and asking for gigs, and I was terrified of phoning off the curb for ages, and then I realised it was just a man in an office, and oh my God, I remember trying to get downstairs at the King's Head, and my flatmate watching me call. It's Peter, isn't it?
Yes, Pete Graham.
Yeah, Pete Graham. Remember him watching me call Pete Graham, and the phone call went, hi, obviously you've got loads of comics to choose from, so you probably won't bother, and that's fine. So I'm coming from Cardiff, so you may as well get someone more local. There will be someone more local, but I've been asked to if I can do a gig in London so people can see me in London. But it's absolutely fine if you don't want to be that person because you haven't seen me already. So, and he just put the phone down, and my friend was like, what was that? And it took a very long time for me to feel able to call people up and say, yeah, yeah, I'm a comedian, I can do this.
Are you happy?
Yeah, because I'm a homeowner and I would never have got to that stage without two things. Comedy, because I was going nowhere, working in office, and B, having a significantly more successful partner. I can really recommend that. Yeah, I haven't dreaded work since I left a real job. It's all fun. It's all great. I'm not very good at corporates. I don't do them anymore, really, because I'm bad at them. And I don't do certain clubs anymore because I was bad at them. But in the main, comedy is a nice life. And you hang out with your friends. And it's also a complete myth that comics are dicks, I think.
Yes.
I worked with some complete twats in offices. But how many twats are there
on
the circuit?
That's a good point. No one ever said, comics can be real dicks. Yeah, compared to who?
Well, yeah,
I used to
work in a gas pipe office in Cardiff, and my line manager was a balls-out racist, and she used to sing racist songs at the desk. And I've shared lifts to gigs with other comics. That's never happened.
That'll do us. Thanks, man.
Great.
So that was Ellis James. Just an absolute
joy to spend some time with Ellis and to talk to him and try and find out what makes him tick. Lots more stuff with Ellis available at comedianscomedian.com/extras by signing up to the mailing list and then waiting for a few moments for that little blue wibbling thing to resolve. You only need to go through all of that sign up nonsense once, and then there's a cookie and it just automatically pings up on your screen whenever you revisit that site. So what I mean is the little blue wobbly thing, it's hellish, and we all know it's hellish, but once it's dealt with, you don't see it again. So, feel free to go there for the extra content, including other extra material from the Russell Howard Show, the Dara O'Brien Show, one of the Milliken shows, lots of... Sarah Milliken, just casually surnaming Milliken there. And that's all of that. So, as I said, almost certainly sold out for the 23rd of January in Soho, but there were other dates coming up in Soho with guests TBC, so jump on those, because hopefully they will also sell out, and you can look all smug. One very big name on the cusp of confirming for that, so that'll be very exciting to find out. I'll chat to you more on the post-amble, but if you are someone who donated over the Christmas period, and there were one or two very special ones, one in particular who didn't want to be named, thank you, you know who you are, but everybody... And seriously, people email me and say, here's a fiver, I'm sorry it's not more, I'm a student, or I'm sorry it's not more, I've got a baby. Please don't apologise. I'm so grateful that you are moved sufficiently by the show to take action, simply clicking, let alone, you know, it's not about the money. But if you can afford it, it's about the money. So thanks, everybody. comedianscomedian.com/donate if you'd like to support the show with a recurring subscription payment of, I suggest, £2, or a one-off donation of, for example, £20. That's all of that. I'll chat to you later, like in a minute or two if you stay. But for now, that concludes the podcast. Speak to you soon. So, welcome to the post-amble. That's what it's officially called now. Someone called Will, a friend of mine called Will, in fact, referred to it as the post-amble. And I thought that's, you know, we all know that I hate the word waffle. And then someone else shortly, I can't track the chronology, but someone else called it the post-amble. So if I've, like, Will definitely thought he was making that name up, but maybe someone else did, or maybe I mentioned it. And then, anyway, whatever it is, I'm crediting him. And there's someone else, possibly a lady called Liz that emailed me. That's what it's called now. So this is this. And look, on the subject of post-ambles, thank you for indulging me earlier this episode with the with me reading out stuff about the stand-up show and people's responses to it. As you will know if you listen to the post-amble, I've recognised that one of my jobs is to convert those guys, not you guys, you're on side, the post at the amblers, but the people that listen just to the show and then switch off, totally, you know, we're all busy, but I've got to convert those guys, right? I've got to convert them to being fans of the stand-up show. And do you know what? How fucking nice was it to release a thing? Because if you sell a thing online, which I've done a little bit in the past, people, you don't really launch, or when you launch it, certainly the level at which I'm at, you sell a thing and people don't all suddenly get back to you at once. Giving a thing away within the space of 24 hours, God, I had so many emails and tweets and lovely things from people about the album. Great. And similarly, you guys who listen to the ambling stuff, you just all got in touch with me at once. Loads of you did. And you said things like this. And okay, this is specifically about the amble, just to bring you up to speed. If this is your first one, welcome. I'm referring specifically to the end of the Pappy's Christmas special episode, the Pappy's Return Christmas special, where I talked about getting an email from my therapist saying, hey man, we haven't spoken to, those aren't the words he used, he's very professional. Some, hey man, I've got this bong racked up, but that is not my therapist. He said, we haven't spoken since April, so maybe our journey is concluded. And I talked about how lovely that was. Here are just a couple of things people said. This is the gamut of reactions. Leighton said, you utter, utter, utter wonderful bastard, Stu. You've just had me blubbing while sat at traffic lights. There were lots of references to having something in people's eye or, you know, tearing up. Thank you. Thank you. It was emotional for me. This was unique, this one. Andy ominously emailed, I want to feel how you're feeling in a few months. Oh, God, no! Oh, Andy, I'm sorry, I've misunderstood this. I've just reread it. I thought he was saying, I want to see how you're feeling in a few months. For now, at least this pod exists. Like, as in, yeah, we've all had breakthroughs, mate. Wait for it and see what... But actually, he said, I want to feel how you're feeling in a few months. Andy, I hope you're listening, because I may have responded too abruptly to your communication with me. Because I thought you were saying, yeah, mate, all right, we'll see how you're doing later. I thought that was worth saying, because obviously, you know, a therapized journey is very much peaks and troughs, and yes, I've made it, and hey, it's all going to be all right, and oh God, I'm back there again. And look, let's not pretend I haven't burst into tears over Christmas, but they were much happier tears, and I don't want to be too flippant about this. My point is, I know I'm not fixed. It's not completely over. I'm not as blissfully happy from now on. I know that. But my point stands, if the therapy journey bit is over and the next phase of the self-care is beginning or is transit, you know, is kind of like we're wiping like Star Wars, a jolting left to right wipe from one phase to another, that's fine. And I'm far enough down the road to know that. And that's what I'm celebrating. So it's not like I'm like, whoa, I'm cured. It's more like, what a milestone. But anyway, I thought I'd include what I thought Andy said, because I thought, balance, but actually realise now, let's honour what Andy said. I want to feel how you're feeling. Well, good for you, man. And it might take months, it might take years, and I hope you get there. I hope we all get there. Finally, Dan said, so glad others feel it. Thank you. This is interesting. He says, comedians don't realise how much their honesty about life helps us normal people. Dan, we're all normal people, mate. Because all we see is people's Facebook highlight reel and no longer share reality of life and honesty of struggles. It's a good point. It's part of the reason I think stand-up is so important, a way of connecting people in a way the falseness of social media won't. Well, I mean, yeah, lots to say about that. I think if you're looking to social media to accurately reflect the world, I think we're all going to be disappointed by that. I try to regard social media as, obviously there are elements where it has to be kind of a business tool for me, but also I try to regard it as, you know, it's entertainment. It isn't reality. It's certainly not a substitute for friendship. You remember we used to say the Comedian's Comedian podcast is not a substitute for writing jokes. Well, bloody Facebook is not a substitute for spending time with people. You know, maybe it's helpful to you in that way, and I'm sure there are ways, loads of ways in which it makes people feel less alone, but it's not as good as being with people. So that's worth saying, obviously worth reiterating. But you're absolutely right. I remember that was like a, ironically, wasn't that a BuzzFeed article? Whenever I read something on BuzzFeed, I like to go, I read somewhere. Never like to credit in the toilet of the internet. Toilet's not fair. The graffiti on the toilet of the internet, whatever. There was some sort of article somewhere about how Facebook is everyone's highlight reel. I think that's obviously what Dan's referring to. You know, the reality is you see your own bloopers, you see your own mistakes, and you see everyone else's presented, mediated version of the world that they want to show you. And that is only one of the reasons why real relationships in IRL are better. But I do think the point he's making, comedians don't realise how much their honesty about life helps people. Yeah, maybe. I certainly have changed the way I think about things having listened to comedians. I've certainly changed the way I think about things having had conversations with friends. But I suppose if you are feeling isolated, then listening to a comedian talk honestly about a thing in an amusing way, in a way that kind of lets the pressure off about that thing, in whatever kind of direction that pressure is pushing you in or compressing you, just to hear. It's like imagine you're a human for a second and you say to someone, oh, I've been really worried about this. I'm worried about this exam. I'm really worried about this thing we've all got to do. I'm really worried about leaving college. I'm really worried about getting a real job. I'm really worried about finding another job after this one, whatever. If you just say, you can think about that on your own and bottle it up and feel terrible about it indefinitely. Or you can just say to someone, I'm really worried about that. And if they go, God, yeah, me too. Jesus, doesn't that knock out 90% of the trauma? Doesn't that just let the... So if you hear Louis C.K., to pick an off-picked example, or whoever it is, if you hear a comedian say, God, I've always worried about that. Isn't that good? Isn't that nice? I mean, I think momentarily of Tom Wrigglesworth's excellent material about hemorrhoids to choose a phenomenally, I was going to say mundane in terms of the topic, not the bit, which is exceptional. But you know, to hear someone just make fun of something, you know, we've all got to go over the top. We're all going to die. You hear a comedian talk about death in a way that makes you go, yeah, you know, absolutely. Well, thank you, Dan. Thanks for making us think about that. And I meant, I wasn't using the royal us there. Thanks for making, do you know, when is the Queen a hive mind when she uses the royal we, when she says, we are very concerned about this. Maybe, I mean, she's a queen, hive, something. Is the Queen a hive mind? I mean, there are the components. Let's say, if you hear me doing anything on that in the Edinburgh show that I present later this year in 2017, if the Queen / hive mind makes it, then maybe I got desperate around June. Components of a joke rather than a joke itself. Last thing, and then I'll let you go. This is optimistic. I was doing some chores this morning. My God, I think of the current touring show has got stuff about being a dad and have you finished all the jobs? Because I equate dads with doing jobs. Now I am one. God, there's a lot of jobs to do. And I was doing some jobs this morning, and the baby's poorly. He's not serious, but it's, you know, awake all night, coughing and wheezing. The experience of seeing your baby ill is so heart-wrenching, my God. I mean, morale was low. We're going on holiday for a week. Tonight, I'm recording this before it's released. We're going on holiday for a week, and it's the sort of pre, it's the calm before the crazy 6 months of touring and prepping in Edinburgh and all the rest of it. So, that was odd. I tried to justify going on holiday then. Did you hear me? What a weasel. I'm obviously worried about it, but it's justifiable, right? Got family time. Morale was a bit low because of poorly baby. And this morning I was doing I had to do some hoovering, and I had to cast out the Christmas tree. You know, hurl the Christmas tree into the street in such an unceremonious way. And I thought to myself, I felt so much better afterwards about, you know, the baby, perspective. He's going to be fine. We've just been feeling guilty because he's ill. Let's get over that. He's going to be fine. It's a holiday. Valid. Let's go on holiday. It's going to be great. I realise that chores are actually morale tasks. Is that a good way of thinking about it? I mean, it sounds like a very fascist way of thinking about it if you assume the role of a dictator increases. What is it? The beatings will continue until morale improves. But it did, honestly, I'm so bad at getting around to doing things, to actually cleaning the oven. Oh, that's needed doing for 5 years, all of that kind of stuff. And actually, really, what you're, it's a small amount of elbow grease and you end up with an enormous boost in morale. Is that an idea? Is that, I mean, there's a scale of ideas, isn't there? Like, is that a bit? Is that just a tweet? Is that just a sentence? Was that worth saying out loud? Oh, that was half a thought. Half an early morning dream thought. But anyway, I'm going to try and put that into my life more. Don't worry, that sounds like I'm going to go all happy clappy, and who knows? Who knows where the journey will take us next? It's the start of a new year. Maybe by the end of this year, the podcast will be 99% life hacks. Speak to you soon, guys. Look out for the Ellis James extras stuff. You know where to find it. And I'll talk to you next week. Ta-da.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.